You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, attending college is more expensive than ever, and for many students, a medical emergency or car repair can make paying for school an impossible task. We'll hear how a UW-Milwaukee program is helping students pay those unexpected bills and focus on the classroom. First, Irma was downgraded to a tropical storm earlier today, but it continues to move into the southeastern United States with heavy winds and downpour. Meanwhile, debris, severe flooding, and power outages have been left in the storm's wake. Here's a clip from the Weather Channel earlier today.
It is weaker, but still in Jacksonville, still seething.
The 8 o'clock update. Irma has been downgraded to a tropical storm. We have record storm surge in Jacksonville, Florida, and now flooding is beginning in Georgia.
Jonathan Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com. He's based in Waukesha County. He joins us today from Atlanta to bring us up to date on Irma. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Rob, it's a pleasure. Nice to talk to you today.
Well, you're not sheltered here in Wisconsin from the storm. You went down to Atlanta. What are you seeing there?
Well, it just looks like a bad weather day here. I'm looking out my hotel window here, looking out towards SunTrust Park, the new home of the Atlanta Braves, and I'm just seeing sheets of rain being driven by wind gusts from 40 to 60 miles per hour. Fortunately, I'm looking at some trees in the area. I haven't seen any branches down. But I know that hasn't been the case in other parts of Georgia, and the number of power outages is mounting in the state.
And where is Irma at this time?
Well, Rob, currently the center of Irma is now moving through parts of central Georgia, right around the Macon, Georgia area, if you're familiar with it, from driving from Wisconsin, say, to Florida. And it's still moving toward the northwest. It's now a minimal tropical storm with 50-mile-per-hour sustained winds. But it still is producing quite a bit of rain, and it's still having quite an impact in parts of the Carolinas, Georgia, Florida, and even Alabama.
Are we still talking about storm surges in some of those places?
Yes, Rob, that's pretty impressive about this storm. You know, the track of the storm has been basically from south to north. So if you envision the winds flowing counterclockwise around an area of low pressure like Irma, we've had a persistent fetch of south-to-north winds that have piled water into parts of South Carolina, the Georgia coast, and into parts of northeast Florida. And that long-lived fetch of winds has really contributed to the major tidal flooding that we've seen in Charleston, South Carolina, and in Jacksonville, Florida.
Now, it's looking like when all is said and done, the worst hit are going to be some of those islands in the Caribbean at the start of the first landfalls. What do we know about the damage it caused on its way toward the United States, the mainland United States?
Well, yes, that's the area that was hit the hardest when Irma was a Category 5 hurricane in Antigua and Barbuda, which is in the northern Leeward Islands, generally to the east of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. That particular group was hardest hit, as well as part of the British and U.S. Virgin Islands, and then also the Turks and Caicos down to the southeast of the Bahamas. That was when the hurricane was really at its fullest fury, with Category 5 winds of up to 185 miles per hour. And unfortunately, what we're hearing out of the island of Barbuda is that anywhere between 85 to 90% of the buildings have been damaged or destroyed. And unfortunately, that's what happens when you have a Category 5 hurricane's eyewall move right over you.
We're talking to Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com. He's based in Waukesha County, talking to us now from Atlanta about Hurricane Irma, now Tropical Storm Irma. And Jonathan, of course, over the weekend, we were watching this hit Florida. What do we know about the track it took and the recovery now, the damage that people are still sorting out?
Well, Rob, the track was really interesting. You know, when you watch on television or you check a forecast online, you'll often see that forecast cone. And the reason the cone is there is because the track sometimes at the center of the hurricane can be uncertain even just one day out from it making landfall. And so it was quite interesting that the eyewall made a little bit of a right turn, a subtle right turn before it made its final Florida landfall near Marco Island. And as a result of that subtle turn, it moved inland over southwest Florida instead of what we had feared would happen, in a track basically just offshore of the west coast of Florida that would drive a storm surge into places like Fort Myers and the Tampa Bay area. So that subtle little jog to the right, while it was very bad for areas in, say, Collier County around Marco Island, and certainly in the Naples area, I think that preserved some areas of western Florida, say Apalachicola and Apalachee Bay and the Tampa Bay areas, from getting that feared big storm surge that we had worried about if the storm had stayed a little bit farther offshore in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. So that's not to minimize what happened in the lower Keys, which took the hardest U.S. hit from that, at least on the mainland. Apparently there was about a 10 to 14 foot storm surge over the lower Keys. So if you can imagine those small lower Keys with, you know, just a foot or two above sea level having 10 to 14 feet of storm surge, you can imagine how frightening that must have been for someone who didn't evacuate.
And now on the scientific side of things, what does it mean that we've downgraded Irma from a hurricane to a tropical storm?
Well, you know, there's not a heck of a lot of difference between a 70-mile-per-hour tropical storm and a 75-mile-per-hour hurricane as far as impact is concerned. And one of the aspects of Irma is that its wind field, in other words, its aerial scope of tropical storm force winds was quite large, you know, not nearly as large as what we saw with Superstorm Sandy in 2012, but it was quite large. It was about, it had a diameter of about over 500 miles. If you think of it as roughly a circle. So these tropical storm force winds have spread quite far inland, as I mentioned earlier, into parts of North Georgia, including the Atlanta metro area, and also into parts of Alabama, and even in the parts of the southern Appalachians in eastern Tennessee and western North Carolina. So even though it's been, you know, quote, downgraded, it's still having some pretty significant impacts in wind and rain and, as we talked about earlier, coastal flooding.
Now, we've seen Irma make landfall just a couple weeks after Hurricane Harvey. Can you talk about the historical significance there?
Yeah, Rob, this is really something. You know, we've had some recent luck with hurricane seasons in the past several years. You know, before we had Matthew last year hit the East Coast, we had gone a few years without any significant landfalls. You know, we had a lot of wind shear in the atmosphere and dry air. But what we've seen here is the first time in history that we've had two Category 4 hurricane landfalls happen in the same hurricane season in the continental U.S. Harvey, and then Irma was a Category 4 when it officially made landfall in the lower Keys yesterday. So that had never happened before in the same season. Even the really busy 2004 and 2005 hurricane seasons where we had Katrina, Rita, Wilma, and we had the four Florida hurricanes in 2004. We didn't have two Category 4 storms hit in the same season. So this is a quite impressive stretch, and unfortunately it comes at quite a price for the U.S.
Now, I understand Hurricane Jose was out there. What do we know about that? Is that going to be anything on a par with the other two?
Yeah, Jose has been out there for quite some time, even as we've been, most of our attention has been on Irma. Right now, Jose is kind of in the Bermuda Triangle, so it's between Bermuda, the southeast Bahamas, but well north of Hispaniola, and it's basically taking a tight clockwise loop over the next several days. And we think by this weekend, the Hurricane Jose will be somewhere to the northeast of the northwest Bahamas. Now, the question becomes whether Jose then curls safely out to sea early about this time next week, or if it gets a little too close to parts of the southeastern United States where we may get at least a brush of tropical storm force winds in the Carolinas, or if it gets close enough that we have to worry about potentially another hurricane strike somewhere in the East Coast early next week. It's just too early to tell right now, but we're still going to have to keep a close eye on it, and yeah, it's a little hard to fathom that we could be looking at a third straight hurricane strike if this Hurricane Jose doesn't turn sharply enough next week.
Before we're done, Jonathan, I want to shift gears. There's been, at least online, a lot of conversation about meteorologists and weather forecasters and journalists going outside in the midst of storms for coverage of those storms. So you see them on video in a place where everybody's been told to take shelter. What do you think about how this is covered by journalists and meteorologists on the ground?
Well, of course, you know, I do work for weather.com and the Weather Company and the Weather Channel. So, you know, for full disclosure,
sure.
we don't send our meteorologists out in the field purposefully in harm's way when their personal safety is at risk. They are experienced. They know how there are logistical things that they do to make sure they're in a safe enough location, but yet can still show you the impacts. So I think it can be done. As long as you have experience and are a professional in doing so, but certainly I share the concern among the public that it's you know, we don't want to encourage people to go out there and film and become YouTube stars if they don't know what they're doing and if they don't understand the power of moving water and if they don't understand that high winds can carry debris with them and that debris can be projectiles. You know, people can certainly get hurt doing that. So, so you really need to know what you do. You either need to be a professional storm chaser with experience, or you need to be a meteorologist or a member of the news media that has had experience covering these storms to keep you safe. It can be done, but again, we don't recommend that someone without experience try that.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com. He joined us from Atlanta today to offer the latest news about hurricane and now tropical storm Irma. The cost of going to college has risen steadily over the years. According to the nonprofit College Board, tuition and fees at the average four-year public university today cost more than three times what they did in 1980, adjusted for inflation. For students who may also be commuting to a school or raising a family, that could put them in a position of taking on more loan debt or dropping out of school altogether. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is aiming to help students struggling with the everyday costs with the new UWM Emergency Grant. Low-income students can apply for a one-time grant of $1,000 to help with things like rent, medical expenses, and other financial stressors outside the classroom. Rebecca Freer is the Interim Dean of Students at UW-Milwaukee. Becky, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, can you give us the details of this emergency grant program? How does it work? Who qualifies for it?
Yeah, so this program is available to undergraduate students who are qualified as low income. And so this means that they are either eligible for a Pell Grant or slightly above a Pell Grant, which is a federal grant for students who have low incomes. So for students who have an estimated family contribution that should pay for college of $7,000 or less, they can apply for the grant. And as long as they have an unforeseen emergency, so maybe they, for example, our most recent grant we just distributed to a victim of Hurricane Harvey who was having trouble getting back to her job and couldn't pay her rent. And so we helped her pay for rent in order to come back to school. So they just apply by the Dean of Students Office or by visiting our website and linking to our emergency grant.
And I think when people think of the cost of college, I obviously think of tuition and maybe books and things like that. This grant seems to be recognizing that there are a lot of other costs that could end up affecting college attendance. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that I found is that our students, you know, when they are figuring out where they want to attend college, they're really price conscious. They're looking at the cost of the institution, how much it's going to cost for them to live on campus or at home, and they're trying to find an institution that is affordable. Oftentimes, they're also counting that they're going to work 20 hours a week or that they'll be able to work full-time over breaks and that they won't have any financial or medical emergencies or any job loss or anything like that. And so they're just making it when they attend school. But when something else happens that comes up, oftentimes those unexpected expenses or the everyday eating, how to spend money on a college campus. Are you going out to eat or are you able to go grocery shopping? Some of those expenses can add up really quickly, and their students just aren't anticipating them. And when they do get them, they often don't have any options. And so sometimes they withdraw or drop out for a little bit until they can get their lives back in order and afford rent or their car bill or whatnot.
How did this program get started in the first place?
Well, you know, this past year was the very first time that grants were available for four-year institution four-year institutions through Great Lakes, who is a financial aid loan distributor and a philanthropy company that is based in Wisconsin. And so when Great Lakes opened this opportunity, we applied. And we were able to apply because we already started building our infrastructure here at UWM. About 3 years ago, we had a student who had substantial financial emergency to the point where we were able to find a private donor to help award her money to pay off a past balance that financial aid was not eligible to cover. This helped her come back to school. And after she came back to school and was successful and recently graduated, that private donor then wanted to help more students. And so she gave the campus money to be able to distribute to students who had financial emergencies. And so with that grant, we were able to build the infrastructure to figure out how to get all the teams on campus the ability to award money really quickly to students when they're in a state of crisis. With that, we applied for this wonderful grant, and then we got it. And so now we're really excited because we expect to be able to help anywhere from 500 to 1,000 students this year.
Talk about some of the students who are served by UW-Milwaukee who might be in this category, maybe low-income people who would be hard-pressed to pay for college and all the associated expenses.
Yeah, you know, often there's a misnomer that, you know, students who attend college, they might have middle or upper middle class backgrounds, they might have more stable financial footing. But among UWM students, 42% of our undergraduate students are Pell eligible, meaning they are low-income students. Some of them might have kids themselves. They might have parents that they're looking after. Some of them might be adults who are saving up everything they can to return to school in order to have a better job. And then many of our students are first generation. That means neither their parents attended college, and so they're trying to figure out what all the costs of college are, why they're navigating it, and they're often the students that are most in need of this grant.
We're talking to Rebecca Freer, Interim Dean of Students at UW-Milwaukee, looking at an emergency grant program aimed at helping mainly low-income students stay in college, even after a financial emergency that might force them to drop out. You've done some research into low-income college students, what drives them and what it takes to help them succeed. What kind of things did you learn?
You know, in my research, I learned that I learned that automatically, you know, our students from low-income backgrounds, they desperately want to have a successful life and to provide for themselves. They, especially if they're from low-income backgrounds and they see their parents struggle, they're trying to figure out a way to give back to their communities, to help their families be successful, and to help themselves be stress or worry-free. But what I found is that, you know, they might not know a whole lot about what it is like to attend college, what the cost of books are like, how to fit into a given day, what it's like to travel from class to class, plus go to a campus job, plus take care of a sibling or a child. And then while they're doing all of these things, when do you have time to eat? When do you have time to go to the grocery store? And how do you do that? Because sometimes our students are also living on their own for the first time. And so they might be trying to figure out how to pay for all of these things, how to live on their own, how to take care of themselves, and how to study, make new friends. And so everything in their lives can transition. And the costs of college can be something that's very daunting. And if they have a family that can't support them, or maybe they don't have a family, or maybe their family doesn't have a lot of funds, they don't want to ask them for that help. And so a lot of times they'll just do without and try to make it. And sometimes they'll go without their resources, their books, without eating, just to make it. This past year, we did a survey on food insecurity among our college students, and we found that 50% of our students who took this survey reported that they went for at least one time during the year without eating for an entire day. And of that, a very high percentage, over 80%, reported that they did it within a month of taking the survey. And so we know it's happening a lot. We know our students are doing without more so than perhaps what they've ever had to do in the past. And what we wanted to help them do is to minimize some of that burden so that we can take their drive and their commitment to their community and their passion for success and their problem-solving nature and helping them thrive by using all those skills to be excellent students and then to give back once they graduate.
Another stereotype that pops into the head about a college student is they're living on campus in a dorm, but in reality, at a lot of schools, they're commuting, they're driving there, and this might be a case where a few hundred dollar car repair can derail their college career. Is that part of what the emergency grant is intended for too?
Absolutely. In fact, so last week we just started awarding this particular grant, and of the three we awarded, two of them were for helping students with their car expenses so that they could commute to school again. Other things that we help students with are, let's say they have an unforeseen medical emergency and they don't know how to pay for those bills. Sometimes the student may lose a job, and it's not so much that the job loss that we'd help cover paying for their wages, but we would help cover their utilities or their rent until they got back on their feet. And so some of those are the expenses that we would most commonly see.
Do you know of other campuses in Wisconsin or elsewhere that do this sort of thing?
There's a number of campuses that have been awarded the grant this year. I know Green Bay has, Edgewood College, and quite a few others have. I do apologize, I don't have it quite off the top of my head, but I know about all in all, I think about 32 universities or colleges received the grant this year in the region of about five or six states.
And briefly, as we wrap up, what would success look like for this program?
Success for this program would be more students graduating and coming back year to year. Ultimately, we want students to graduate and then give back to their communities.
And for UWM students listening anyway, where would they go to find out more info?
You would go to the UWM Dean of Students website. It's uwm.edu/deanofstudents, and you'll be able to click right on Emergency Grant and apply.
Becky, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Rebecca Freer, Interim Dean of Students at UW-Milwaukee, talking about an emergency grant the school is making available for low-income students struggling with the costs of college. If you're at another campus that might have that program, I imagine you could check with your local Dean of Students office there as well. Right now, as hurricane season continues, several western states are dealing with a different problem, a severe fire season. Wildfires are still burning in Oregon, Washington, California, and Montana. Parts of Glacier National Park have burned, and smoke and ash are a continuing problem, making air quality a concern in the West and beyond. John Hopewell joins us now. He's an earth and science specialist for the Capital Weather Gang at the Washington Post. John, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Well, as of today, where are the most difficult wildfires in the West?
Well, right now there's about 123 large fires that are active and about 2 million acres that are on fire, and primarily in the Pacific Northwest, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and down into Northern California, but also Montana. Montana is probably one of the biggest or hardest hit states right now. They have almost 1 million acres have burned total in Montana, and there's some 500,000 on fire as we speak.
Now, we're watching this from Wisconsin, and we get, images of a fire here and a fire there. But overall, is this a particularly bad year for wildfires?
Yeah, this is a bad year. In Montana, it's expected to probably be in the top two or three all-time in terms of acreage burned. In other states, it's not so much the acreage that's burned. It's the impacts and the amount of smoke that's being generated, which is unprecedented.
And is this a bunch of small stories where there's local conditions here and there and they all happen to be happening the same year? Or is there some wider, I guess, climate or weather phenomenon that's leading to this big fire year?
Yeah, fires can sometimes be a local issue, but this one is a regional issue, and that's why we have fires burning everywhere. This winter, we had above average rain and snowfall in most of the West. But then we came into a drought early in the summer, and many places in Montana haven't seen rain in over 2 months. So you have a combination of a hot and dry summer, actually one of the hottest summers on record, combined with a lot of dead trees from the bark beetle, which is expanding its territory because of increased temperatures from climate change. So this is an unusual season with lots of fires burning, and because of a massive ridge of high pressure, which has parked itself over the western U.S. most of the summer.
And we hear about El Niños and La Niñas. Are either of those involved here? Are either of those a factor?
Not exactly. It's more about this what they call synoptic level high pressure ridge, which has just parked itself over the western U.S. And when you get a high pressure you get air that's warm and stagnant and suppresses. It actually pushes down. So when this smoke rises, it can't go too high, and it's actually sinking and filling in a lot of the valleys out west, creating a prolonged air quality issue.
Right. Can you talk about the kind of impacts of that low-lying smoke from these fires? What is it meaning for people who live in those areas?
Yeah, it's pretty detrimental to your respiratory health. One thing that seems to have changed is 20, 30 years ago, the fire season would usually start, you know, July, maybe early August after the snows have totally melted. But now the fire seasons are starting much sooner. In Colorado, there was fires in early March, which is just weird. And so you're having prolonged amounts of smoke that are hanging in the valleys. Bozeman, Montana has been seeing smoke in the Gallatin Valley since July. So it's turning into a potential public health crisis where the smoke is lingering for the entire summer.
And we've seen maps, satellite maps, showing that smoke spreading across the country and here in Wisconsin. And I believe I've a handful of times smelled that smoke from out west. Am I right about that? Could that be possible?
Yeah. Yes. No, absolutely. Southern Wisconsin has been impacted by smoke from both Canadian fires and fires coming from the Pacific Northwest. That's just how incredible this season has been. There was a flare-up about 10 or 11 days ago that pumped smoke into southern Wisconsin. It hopped on the westerlies and the jet stream. And, yeah, what you smell is smoke from about 1,500 miles away.
Yeah, that was, we switched the air in the studio one time, and all of a sudden we were smelling wildfire smoke, like, during the show. And that was exactly, I think, when you just mentioned that. You're not getting it as far east as D.C., I assume.
You can't smell it or see it, but on satellite and certain spectrums, you've been able to see traces of it in New York, but no, it hasn't been, noticeable.
This may be a stupid question, but does having all that smoke in the atmosphere itself change the weather in any way?
It can, yeah. I mean, it can lower temperatures. The Portland, Oregon was supposed to hit 109 degrees a month or so ago, and because of the thick layer of smoke, it acted like a cloud, and it suppressed the temperatures, and it only reached 106. So it can reduce the amount of solar radiation that's coming in. It can reduce the temperatures. It has an effect.
Only 106. I mean, that for the places we're talking about, San Francisco's, Portland, Seattle's hitting triple-digit weather. These are places that aren't built for that kind of temperatures. This is a potential hazard, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of people in San Francisco, or most people in San Francisco, don't have air conditioning. So when it hit 109 there, that creates a lot of discomfort. It stresses the elderly. And it's so anomalous. It's so statistically anomalous. The average high that day should have been 70 degrees in San Francisco, that it cannot be contributed to some, it's not a natural condition. It's man-made induced global warming, which is helping these temperatures get that high.
We're talking to John Hopewell from the Capital Weather Gang, looking at wildfires up and down the western United States. And John, I want to follow up on that point. I know it can be hard to say this particular weather event is related to climate change, but can you talk about the role of climate change in these high temperatures out west and these wildfires?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're right. You can't peg any one event to climate change. But what I like to say to people is if you went to 100 doctors and 99 of them said you had cancer and you should start chemo immediately, what would you do? Well, 99 out of 100 climate scientists are saying that man is contributing to global warming and we should do something about it. So it is a contributing factor, and it's only going to get worse unless we curb our CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions.
And I've read that usually in wildfire season, we can concentrate our firefighting resources in smaller areas, in the areas with the worst fires. Are we getting stretched thin with fires in so many different states now?
Yeah, we are super stretched thin. We're at a level 5 preparedness right now. That's the highest level. We have 25,000 firefighters on the fire line actively. Firefighters have been coming in from all over the country to support the efforts out in the West. The Forest Service Firefighting Fund is nearly depleted, and there's really the fires are going to go until the snows come.
I've seen some reports of wet weather now in some of the states affected. Is that going to start to help turn things around?
Yeah, we have the fall equinox coming. I mean, old man winter is coming, so the fires by themselves will start to die out. The days are getting shorter, the temperatures are getting cooler, humidities are rising. These are all favorable conditions for fire suppression. So, eventually Mother Nature will extinguish them.
Is that 100% for sure? Because not that long ago, we had droughts in, I know, Northern California and elsewhere. It's not 100% sure thing that we're going to get the rain.
That's true. It's not 100%, and it's not 100% that it would fully extinguish. Some of these fires can smolder underground. They can smolder in the roots. But in the Northern Rockies, it typically gets so cold and snowy in the winter that it puts it out. Southern California, Southern Arizona, Southern New Mexico, they could have their fire season perhaps go year-round.
And can you talk about how much these wildfires have been close to big or to populated areas? Sometimes they're kind of out in the middle of nowhere and we're mostly just seeing the smoke. How much has this affected people where they live?
Well, Portland, Oregon, with that fire in the gorge, had major impacts. It was ash falling from the sky, reminiscent of the Mount St. Helens eruption back in 1980. Seattle has also been impacted. So typically those cities don't experience the type of smoke they've been getting. Montana, Missoula, Butte, Bozeman, Helena, they're more accustomed to smoke than the Pacific Northwest.
And what are you watching for now as these 100-plus wildfires are still burning?
I'm watching for the winter coming. I'm watching for the snows and the cold weather and hope that they come sooner than later.
And is this, you think, going to be a freak year, or is this getting closer to a new normal?
I think it's getting closer to a new normal. It is a, quote, freak year, but I think we're going to be seeing more fires, and we need to start have a national discussion about our development and land use and how we treat forest fires. There's been a long history of fire suppression. Many of the forests out west, especially the lodgepole pine forests, have what's known as serotonous cones, and those cones need fire to germinate. And what we've been doing for 100 years is suppressing those fires. So we have forests that are unhealthy, they're cluttered, and then we have the pine bark beetle, which is killing many trees and providing more fuel. So I think we're entering a new normal of increased wildfire activity.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
John Hopewell is an earth and science specialist for the Capital Weather Gang at the Washington Post. He joined us to talk about wildfires burning in the western United States. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. All right, turn down the lights, maybe curl up with a blanket. We're going to talk about scary books and movies. The movie It, based on the Stephen King novel, came out over the weekend. It did really good with record-breaking attendance for a horror movie, record-smashing even. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite horror movie or book? Did you see It over the weekend? That's the new film, again, from Stephen King's novel. What do you think about scary books made into films? Would you want your favorite read to become a movie? Tell us about the ones that work, the ones that don't, and if you shy away from the genre, I'd like to hear about that, too. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Producer Amanda Magnus is our resident horror fan. Hey, Amanda.
Hey, Rob.
So you watch, I used to watch more. I don't watch them as much anymore or read horror as much, but you're big into the genre.
I love it. I love being afraid. I love kind of the thrill and the safety of being afraid from your couch or in a movie theater where obviously nothing is coming out to get you.
And one of your favorites, you've got a lot of favorites, but you're famous for liking the movie The Shining.
Oh my God, I love the movie The Shining. So we have a clip to play from you. Just a reminder, The Shining is based on the 1977 Stephen King novel set in the isolated hotel in the Colorado Rockies, the Overlook Hotel. Here's the clip.
Wendy.
Sally!
Darling, light of my life. I'm not gonna hurt you. You didn't let me finish my sentence. I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just going to bash your brains in.
Fun stuff there. It is a pretty powerful movie, though I guess Stephen King himself hated it, right?
He didn't like it, and to be fair, it's not a direct adaptation of his novel. It kind of takes it in a different direction that is, I think, a work of art in its own right, but I also love the book.
Well, let's see what our callers think. We're asking you for your favorite horror books, movies, or book-to-movie adaptations, for that matter, with the release of Stephen King's It. Nick is with us first in West Allis. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What's your favorite?
I love The Conjuring with Ed and Lorraine Warren. I feel like it's a very well-done movie with a great story that's told, and they're real people that have recorded it throughout their careers where they performed exorcisms.
And are you a fan of horror movies, scary movies in general, or is this just one that happens to speak to you?
It's one that I feel like it is done extremely well. I mean, I am a fan in general. I watched pretty much every scary movie except for It so far. I watched, you know, Saw and everything. So I think that this one definitely speaks to me more just with the story.
Nick, thanks a lot. He said, you know, kind of real. That makes me think of the Blair Witch Project, not a real story, but definitely made out to look as though it was a few people with a camera.
Yeah, Rob, that's another one of my absolute favorites. Love that movie. Watch it almost every year.
And that was a unique moment in hype because they were the first ones to figure out how to use the internet to hype something, I feel like.
Yeah, that was huge. I remember that when it first came out, there was so much word of mouth behind that movie. It was really, really popular.
Thanks a lot, Nick, for getting us started. We'll go next to Dave in Oconomowoc. Dave, what's your favorite?
My favorite book would be Amityville Horrors. Yeah, it's the scariest book I have ever read. I had to keep on reading it because I was too afraid to put it down.
You're afraid to put it down. And did you watch the movie of the Amityville Horror?
I watched the movie. The movie didn't do that much for me, but the book, boy, that sure did.
Dave, thank you so much for bringing that one up. Amityville Horror, the book, not the movie. That's tough because sometimes the book can do things and trigger the imagination where the movie just fills in too many gaps.
Yeah, I really enjoy reading scary books because a lot of times the way that I imagine things is as scary as possible. But then when I watch a horror movie, sometimes that shows me things that I never would have dreamed of myself. So it's like Both offer a lot.
And I like a nice thing about scary movies is what they don't show you. Like the first Freddy Krueger, Nightmare on Elm Street, you really didn't see him that much. And it was way scarier than when he was out kind of clowning around on camera all the time.
Exactly.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are taking your calls for the best scary book or movie with the very successful release of the movie It. We go next to Ed on the line in Madison. Ed, hi.
Hi. I saw a movie about 60 years ago, and I guess you could say early impressions can sometimes be lasting. It was called The Thing. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it.
Sure. I haven't seen the original. I've seen the remake by John Carpenter. The
yep.
Thing stuck with you, Ed?
It was the original, and, well, it was about a flying saucer that got stuck in the ice of the Arctic, and they brought in this... It turned out to be a vegetable man stuck in the ice, and they made a mistake by putting a electric blanket by mistake over the ice containing this foreign
thing.
Visitor, and it melted out. Turned out his sustenance was blood, and every time they'd cut off an appendage of this monster, he'd regrow another one because he was vegetable.
Interesting, Ed. Thanks a lot. That's The Thing. The John Carpenter one was really different. I think it was set in the Antarctic, I remember.
Yes. Oh, my God, yes.
But
that's one of my partner's favorites.
Oh, really? And that's scary in the sense that it could impersonate the people.
Anybody.
Yeah, we've had John Carpenter, the director, that he was on Central Time once to talk about his music. That was a high point in my career.
Oh, my God.
I love John Carpenter's music, too. Thanks a lot, Ed. We'll go next to Kathy in West Bend. Kathy, hi.
Hello. This movie might be a bit dated now, but it was scary when I saw it, which was in the late 60s, early 70s. And the whole idea of the movie was that this couple that was going out, they the guy was kind of a loser. He was attempting to be a photographer and not very successful at it. And he didn't want to marry his girlfriend who was pregnant. So she had an abortion, which upset him terribly. And some years later, when she had been married to another person and they had a child, his goal was to make her, not for himself to kill her new baby, but to make him, or make her rather, kill her new baby because she had, in his view, killed his child.
Wow. Kathy, thanks a lot for sharing that one. Daddy's Gone A-Huntin', from the 60s, I guess. Thanks a lot for that call, Kathy. We're taking your calls for favorite scary books and or movies with the release of Stephen King's It. Let's go to another caller, Matt, on the line in Green Bay. Matt, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's yours?
Mine is Carnival of Souls, which is more of a spooky movie than a scary movie. And what I like about it is that there are, it's the way that it's filmed, they have really common things that people kind of think of as really creepy, like being inside of an elevator, or and it just sort of not feeling right. That, or if you remember back in the 50s or 60s, I remember in the late 60s going up on one of those platforms that you would use to raise or jack your car. They used to let us do that as kind of a kid for a ride. It was also kind of scary and surreal, and actually that's what the movie does.
Matt, thanks a lot. Carnival of Souls, have you seen that one?
I've actually seen it in a horror movie class that I took, one of my favorite classes of all time.
I bet.
Yeah, I remember it being very surreal and eerie, creepy, that
spooky,
kind of scary movie.
As he said.
Yeah.
We heard from Miranda on Facebook, the first Paranormal Activity is hers. She says, I saw it in the theater, the simple scares worked on me. And Linda writes, I love the book Pet Sematary by Stephen King, creepy and good.
Oh my God, that's the first Stephen King book that I ever read, and it was horrifying.
I bet. One more quick call. Gary in South Milwaukee. Gary, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Quick, what's your movie, Gary?
The Exorcist. That scared me as a kid, and made me believe in God.
All right. That is a powerful movie, Gary. Thank you so much. Are you going to see, briefly, Amanda, It in the theater?
I'm going to wait till I read the book.
Reading the book first, I think. I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to get around to either. Thanks a lot, Amanda. Always fun to talk horror movies with you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much for all of your calls. You can keep things going over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Share your favorite scary books and movies there.